BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 6.
Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Orbital.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved artists around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guests are a pair of musicians who have been responsible for some of the most important, exciting and memorable electronic music the UK has ever produced. Right from their very first single, 1989's Chime, they found themselves one of the key acts in revolutionising dance music. They attracted audiences far beyond the normal dance genre. Their live shows were more like rock gigs in scale, visuals and energy, and they made albums that stood up as proper, complete, cohesive artistic statements. They also blended electro, film soundtracks and an anti-establishment punk ethos, and some 35 years since they started, they're still as loved as ever. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time my guests Phil and Paul Hartnell, Orbital. In this show, we talk about Phil and Paul's hugely eclectic musical upbringing, their love of punk and reggae and film soundtracks and early electro, and two very different musical obsessions, where a fascination with electronics and sequences melded with a passion for songs that can move your heart and your feet and also carry a message. We talk about the making of Chime, their breakthrough first albums, that legendary 1994 Glastonbury performance, their split and reunion, and the story behind their iconic onstage torch glasses. There's also an awesome story about Kate Bush asking the Queen for an autograph, plus some brilliant songs. But I started by asking Phil and Paul, as I do with all my guests, when were they first aware of music?
Ooh, I mean, it's a, you can drill back on that one, can't you? Yes. For me, it could be TV theme tunes. It could be Terrified and Enthralled by the Doctor Who theme tune, which is always a big thing in our house. Another, or the Lost in Space theme tune.
Another one was
Mary, Mungo and Midge, you know.
Treasure Island.
Treasure Island, that's too early
for
me.
Oh, was that me?
That's you.
The Persuaders.
You know. That's a good one
as
well.
That's a great one, that is.
Also, my mother's cousins used to live on an estate. Well, they used to have parties all the time. I was under eight and Paul was four, around that sort, yeah. And they were DJs, funnily enough, with little 7-inch singles. And one used to do Tamla Motown and the other one used to do Trojan Reggae. So essentially, you know, it was late 60s, early 70s. So that was all the Jamaican influence that came over, which heavily influenced the dance floor, in my opinion, you know, because they brought all the sex onto the dance floor, if you ask me, the way they grooved and everything like that. That's what we grew up on, really. That was our first major influence, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I always remember those parties, being a little kid, sort of being picked up by your aunties and having to dance around with your feet on their feet, to Israelites by Desmond Decker and things like that. But it was always the Trojan Reggae that kind of got me. I'd never really been into Motown, but the reggae stuff just had a thing that just used to draw me in as a kid. There were times when I look back and I am haunted by my youth. Oh, but my joy of today is that we can all be proud to say to be young, if gifted black is where it's at. Young, Gifted and Black was another favourite one of mine.
Young. And with the Tamla Motown stuff, which was all the Jackson 5, and we had the cartoon of the Jackson 5. And I can remember when I was eight, and I asked, all I want is the Jackson 5 record. And then I opened it up and got Ben by Michael Jackson.
I
just wanted the greatest hits. What's happened to ABC and all that? One, two, three.
It's really interesting that, like, so early on, if it's your cousins, you look up to your cousins. These kids that you kind of look up to are playing music.
Yeah.
People in the family are dancing. Everyone's having a good time.
Yeah.
That's kind of really what you ended up doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was all there from the start.
It was.
So if Ben was your first single, what was your first single?
I'm going to say Tears of a Clown by The Beat. That was the first meaningful single. I mean, my life changed when I heard that track. I was in the bath Sunday night listening to The Child Rundown. I went in a child and came out a man. And I know that sounds absolutely like a Carry On film. I know what you're all thinking. It was monumental. I went in thinking about Airfix toy soldiers and Action Man, and then came out thinking about sharp suits and girls. It literally changed my life. It was just spine tingling. I just thought, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. What is it? How do I do that? And I just thought, well, you've got to start by getting yourself a sharp suit and talking to girls. Oh, God. You know, and honestly, I came out with a whole different agenda to life. You know, I went into Pat Moore's, the electronic shop in Sevenoaks, who also sold singles. Found it. I had to guess the name because I didn't really know. You know when you're not recording something and there's no way of finding out. And I picked it up and said, could you play this for me? And they put it on. I went, at first, you know, dang, dang, dang. Ding. As soon as that happened, I went, that's it, I'll buy that.
Did you have a similar, like, okay, music, this is, I want to be doing this? Was your relationship with it a
me,
bit different?
No, my drive was just like when I heard an electronic sound, like, oh, way back, I don't remember where, it was high-energy gay disco music, basically. And it was just the intrigue of what the sound of a synthesizer, there's nothing like it. You can go, you know, you can make all these wonderful noises. And it was just a drive. An interest just to make. I never thought, I'm going to be in a band or anything. And then when I left school and started getting some money, Paul was obviously much more driven into being in the band, and he knew the guitar and stuff like that. I didn't know anything. I bought a drum machine, bought a synthesizer, and let's work out this together.
And the bedroom new order.
yes. Because we have got a mysterious elder brother, Dr. Gary Hartnell. He ended up being the chief consultant at the premature baby care unit at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I know. How random is that? I raided his record things, and his records cupboard was full of Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, all this progressive rock sort of stuff, which it was very interesting to me because it wasn't a traditional song. But also what he did have was Autobahn, and I thought I was in heaven.
So that's one of yours.
That was a big moment for me. It was the story, whole album, story of a motorway. Like, how brilliant is that? And, it's the concept.
I think there's this with early electronics. There's a lot that tie it together to punk, to the ethos of punk. It was like, here's just a bunch of circuits and this very basic bit of equipment. Here's a scrappy old guitar. You can just do it. You can make noise out of both of those instruments, and it's valid.
Excellent, that's what I thought.
We're frowned upon by, rock royalty at the time or whatever. That's the thing, isn't it?
Fun, fun, fun off the Autobahn. Fun, fun, fun off the Autobahn. Fun, fun, fun of the Autobahn.
Another first gig?
First gig I ever went to, he took me when I was 12. He knew I liked two-tone, as I explained earlier. And the Body Snatchers were supporting Split Enz. And so he thought he would take me, because of the Body Snatchers, to Hammersmith Odeon. Our parents dropped us off, and I could not believe the volume that they were playing. I remember the Body Snatchers coming on, plucking a string, and just thinking, oh, my God. And then it just, like, the wave of noise. They were great, but Split Enz blew my mind. I didn't know anything about them. Right. They came on to loads of ultraviolet light, wearing suits that showed up shapes like Mondrian,
yeah,
and things like that. I'd never seen anything like it.
They did have a good stage.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was great.
And he bought me my first drink as well. That one is another first.
What was it? What was the drink?
It was vodka and bitter lemon. I used to sip my mum's in the pub at various times, so it was the only drink I knew. And you know, it's very nice.
But you can't get bitter lemon anymore.
I don't know if you can.
I've never seen it.
It's a shame.
I got you. That's all I want. I won't forget. That's a whole lot. I don't go out. Not now that you're in. Sometimes we shout. But that's no problem.
So do you remember your first time in the studio? The first time you got your hands on faders?
Well, I never got my hands on stuff. My first time in a studio was when I was about 13, 14. I had a naughty friend who had a social worker, and we were trying to form a band, a punk band, in the village at the time. And she knew this, and so said, all right, I'm going to organise a day for you two to go to a studio. So we went to a studio in London, and she said, oh, The Jam are recording. And so we were like, oh, my God. And we got in there, and there's Paul Weller sat on the sofa eating Chinese takeaway, and he got up and said, oh, hello, lads, all right. And he was absolutely lovely, chatting to us, recommending we listen to the Psychedelic Furs and things like that. And they were recording War, the B-side of their last ever single, which we didn't know. And during the time there, John Weller was there, his dad, who was their manager. He wrote out a cheque for £1,000. This is the early 80s. So that's
a lot of money.
I mean, it wasn't all for us. But gave it to the social worker and said, use this to buy equipment for any kids you've got that need equipment to help them get on the straight and narrow. We went back absolutely buzzing. And it was the impetus to make us properly start the band. And we ended up, you know, knocking on someone's door to buy a drum kit that we'd seen in their garage and things like that, and got it together. I mean, it's funny because Paul Weller, I met him years later, not that long ago, at a festival where he was playing with the High Flying Birds and things like that. And our mate Mikey Rowe is the keyboard player for Noel Gallagher. And he introduced us to Paul, and I recounted this story. And he had a tear in his eye, because I don't think he knew that his dad had given the money.
Oh,
it really gave me validation of, right, you can do this. Paul Weller and John Weller have said, you can do this, just go and do it. And that's, you know, we got our first punk band together on the back of that.
The Six Music Festival
2024.
Bringing you artists like you've never seen them before.
And you can listen back to all your favourite festival moments featuring
Hack Baker, Young Fathers, C-Mac, Gossip, Jordan Rakai, and The Smile.
Plus,
DJ sets, as well as some of the brightest and best new talent from BBC Introducing.
Relive all the performances from this year's Six Music Festival. Watch on iPlayer. Listen on BBC Sounds. Just search for Six Music Festival.
BBC Radio. BBC Radio 6 Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with Orbital.
So when was the very first time you made music together as kind of a collaborative effort?
Well, I used to come back with, like, by a random synthesizer, and we'd just discover it together. You know, wouldn't we, really?
We'd play with the
drum
machine.
And then find out we need a box that doesn't make any sound so the drum machine could talk to the synthesizer. It's like, oh, how annoying is that?
And then begins the studio arms race. But we'd just experiment. You know, we found if you put the drum machine through my distortion pedal, it sounds like industrial music. It was amazing. You know, we could sound like the Severed Heads and things like that just by putting stuff through distortion. It was brilliant.
I did see an Open University once where they showed you that you can make a microphone out of the speaker bit of a telephone. And so
we tried it, didn't we?
Yeah, we got one from the local shop.
I think we just put one box that was under the table in our parents' house.
Oh, yeah, my mum used to have loads of them. Yeah, that's right.
Stuck it to an oil drum.
Yeah.
Sounded crap.
There's that early footage of Kraftwerk, isn't there, when, like, they're playing what looks like beer mats covered in tinfoil with little sort of metal sticks, and you're like, is that how they're doing it? Like, they've just made that stuff.
Yeah.
It's so freeing to understand that, like, technology is not intimidating. It's as much of a tool as anything else.
And I love making a sound with a synth. It's just, you get lost in it forever.
Let's pick an artist that's meant a lot to you throughout your life to play at this juncture, who maybe illustrates what we've just been talking about.
Well, there's so many different people. I could pick Crass. They were a big thing for me growing up. They were my moral compass, coming from a village in Kent called Dunton Green, where everybody had a straight down the line attitude, you know, that we were living in the Carry On, Benny Hill era. And Crass taught me everything I knew at the time about feminism, vegetarianism, and, you know, avoiding factory farming, not accepting the system and that kind of thing. And, you know, I became a proper mini anarcho-punk and used to go on anti-vivisection marches and things like that. You know, for me, I think it's Batter Motel, the opening track of Penis Envy, was the one that confounded me the most, because it was about feminism. And that was the hardest one to understand as a 14-year-old boy. It was like, yeah, but hang on, but mums do go home and cook the dinner. They do stay and look after the kids. How's this going to work? You know, and just getting my head around that. But that album has remained with me. You know, I still play it now if I'm in the mood for something feisty. But that particular track, from the point of view of a woman in a relationship, it just always blows my mind. And it's one of the few Crass tracks without any swearing as well.
Our little girls of about 6 or 7 were asked, what do they like to do? And then sometime later, the same question was asked in a slightly different form. They were asked, what do little girls like to do?
Crash me!
Tell me about first hearing about electro or just
Well, so from these sort of high-energy stuff that, you know, is the only sort of stuff that was making music out of drum machines and stuff, then mid-70s, I suppose, and then electro, Street Sounds Electro, was a compilation record label that brought a lot of the American electro stuff over so that we could get to hear it, because, you know, back in those days, it's about exposure. How do you know you like electro if you never hear it? You know, especially nowadays, it's completely different, obviously. Yeah, so electro, that's when we sort of kicked off, didn't we, really? I would say, like, got us
Well, it, we were copying. Already doing stuff, but that was, like, a new thing that was happening, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we'd kind of ignored it, because we discovered it in 84, but we, you know, it had a funny kind of soul boy reputation where we were from. That it's just some music that soul boys listen to. And then we used to do a thing called Beat Mondays where we were working together in our dad's building sites, because our dad was a builder. And we used to go to the hotel at the end of our village and just go drink and have a party just for two, and then refuse to go home till after 12 o'clock. So we'd end up, when they kicked us out of the hotel, we'd sit in the recreation ground and listen to John Peel. And he played Kid Frost, a Kid Frost electro track. And we went, wow, that's amazing. Yeah. We've got to get into some of this. So we, you know, in our lunch break the next day, drove up to Bromley, which is the nearest place you could get decent records, bought a Street Sounds electro album each, took them home, took them to our own bedrooms and said, you know, meet on the stairs after side one. And we listened to side one and then met on the stairs and went, yeah, that was excellent. That was really good. And we just started swallowing up those Street Sounds electro albums, which were a brilliant way of getting all this music that would be really expensive imports on 12 inches and things like that, but a good way of digesting all that fantastic music that was coming out of America.
Yeah, there's some brilliant tracks on there. Let the Music Play, Shannon.
I was going to say, that's the standout track, isn't it? And weirdly, probably the first time we'd ever heard a 303 as well, because that's a 303 bass line, as I've found out since. But that's just a real standout track for me. We started dancing and love put us into a groove. As soon as we started to move, the music played while our bodies displayed through the dance. The love picked us up.
Chime has been oft told, but you were saying, before we start this interview, you were saying you've got pretty good memory. How much do you remember of actually putting Chime together and that? Because it's kind of passed into sort of band legend, hasn't it? Like, you've got this image of it sort of happening with a bunch of tin cans under some stairs. But do you remember actually piecing it together and thinking, this is good?
I remember everything.
Really?
But whether what I remember is true,
that's a problem.
Is another thing. But it doesn't matter. You know.
It's your story. You can tell it how you want.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It was a Wednesday night. And I remember...
You can remember what day of the week it is.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Again, you know, other days are available. But it was one of those weeknights. Quite a nice summery day, I seem to remember. And I just looked at my 6-input 4-track machine and thought, why am I only ever recording 4 tracks? It's got 6 inputs. I could just bypass the recording, go straight into my dad's tape deck, and have 6 tracks available. So I thought, okay, let's knock something up quickly and do that. And so I just got sampling with one of my dad's old easy listening records and thought, oh yeah, that's quite nice, quite like that. Sounds a bit like Strings of Life. Nice one. Oh, let's get a bit of Acid House in there. That's another track. And 2 drum machines. Yeah, go on. And just kept going until there was nothing left to, you know, I'd run out of inputs.
and thought, oh, I need another section now. It's just all one thing. It's like, okay, do an intro section. Right, okay, done. Right, let's just go. What am I going to do with that spare sample? I don't know. I maybe use it. By this point, my mates had arrived. We were going to the pub and they were all sat on the sofa and they were going, come on, hurry up. And I said, I've just got to do this. Just got to record this. They said, oh. I started, it went wrong. I said, I had to stop, and they all went, oh, God, you know. And I said, no, hang on. Jammed it for 10 minutes. I said, right, we can go.
We can go.
And they were all leaving the room already by that point, apart from one guy called Farrakh, who was sat at the end of the sofa with narrowed eyes. And just as I was going to the door, he went, that was pretty good. And he's the only one who said that. And I just thought, I didn't think anything of it. It was only when I played it to Jazzy M in his shop, Vinyl Zone, he went absolutely ballistic listening to it. He said he couldn't play it in the shop because it was Friday night when I took it up to him. He said, we're selling, you know. Back in the day when you had three rows of DJs all bidding for, you know, white labels and things like that. And he put it on. He was crouched down behind the desk and his grin just got bigger and bigger. Then he just whipped his headphones off and said, oh, I don't care, I'm going to play it in the shop. He said, watch this. And played it loud in the shop and all the hands shot up. And it was like, I was just like, going on, and they were all going, oh, he said, you can't have it, it's only on tape. But you, and they all went, oh, and he said, yeah, but you will be able to in a couple of weeks. And that's when he, you know, started Ozone Records, yeah, and pressed it up. And then before you know it, 3 months later, we had six record companies trying to license it and ended up on Top of the Pops, which is, you know, absolutely bonkers.
First rush when those things happen, which happens very rarely. If you're lucky enough to be in a band when, yeah, you have that little moment, that is the tip of the roller coaster. It's the best feeling. Can you remember how that people love this?
Do you remember we played at Synergy and we had that moment?
Yeah,
we were playing at with the Shaman at one of their Synergy nights they used to do. They were the first people to invite us to a proper London gig. We'd only done one before that in, you know, local Bernie Inn kind of place.
I was going to ask you about that, the first actual gig.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I reckon, you know, this was our first proper pro-level gig. We got 15 quid each. And and we played, you know, our tracks, and we were going to end on Chime. Not because we thought it was big, it's just that's just the way it turned out. And we started playing Chime, and there was a ripple of excitement in the audience. And I remember thinking, bloody hell, they know it. They know this track. And it was like, wow. That's impressive, you know, and it just carried on for the rest of the year after that, didn't it?
35
years. Yeah, it's been going on longer, but that, you know, yeah. That.
But what was good about that track, it was what would be called an anthem now, which wasn't even a word then, but at that time there was a trend, early 90s, like a trend of getting a PA in the clubs, like, so it'd be Rosillo coming in and doing singing songs, and, you know, a lot of the time people just set up a keyboard on an ironing board and just like, oh yeah, here we are for 20 minutes. Whereas we just set our studio up on stage and ran it all live and stuff like that, and then that was because of Chime. So we'd go, well, no, we need half an hour and stuff like that, and then play tracks all Satan and completely wipe the dance floor. But that was, we were sort of trying to promote ourselves more of an electronic band rather than, oh, producer, DJ types. Yeah. But that was like an indie band pub circuit, if you like, that club, which was really pivotal in helping us get out playing our music to crowds, which you didn't really have that choice. There wasn't a vehicle for that before, you know, so it was really, really good. And because we were playing live, nobody knew what we were doing up there, pretty much. but it was the rawness of it, because it was really raw and ragged, and we, you know, there's no backing track, so we improvise with the structure of the song and jamming with the synths when we're up there. So it, you can tell it's not like the record, but it's raw, and I think people just feel that and appreciated it at the time. But, yeah, you know, I think that's how we got away with it, really. But yeah,
you found your people, didn't you? It's like, you know, Shelley's Disco, not so much. But, you know, going over to see David Holmes, you know, was the beginning of a lifelong friendship. And, you know, we met people in Pure in Edinburgh, like Rock and all of that lot, who ended up being our tour manager and things like that. It was a beginning of a whole network of dance music people around the country. It's where we first met Sasha, Evil Eddie Richards, people like that. And it was like, it was just brilliant. You know, you're just making all these friends and everybody joining up and, you know, the Oscillate lot from Birmingham, HIA and all of that. And in places like that where they got it, they were playing unusual, strange, dubby kind of house music. And so we'd go places like that and it fit in perfectly, wouldn't we?
Well, we teamed up with a Club Dog, actually.
Of course.
And we tried this thing called, like, the Midi Circus, which was like a travelling club, as it were, played in rock and roll venues, but it was all based on live... I mean, we had a few DJs in between the changeover and stuff, but it was all essentially live electronic music.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? Us, Spooky, Aphex Twin, System 7, Drum Club, just all rotating and, you know, no headline, just all playing at different times and trying to get late licences till 2 o'clock, so it would have a club kind of vibe as well. It was brilliant.
Yeah, because this is the thing that's like, aside from the songs, there's these sort of two parallel things that are really powerful in your kind of rise and staying there. One is that thing, as you say, these live shows that were existing in a kind of rock circuit to an extent, dragging in people. And also, when you start making albums, they're albums. You know, first one is obviously drawn from different times, but they all stand up and always have them as complete bodies of work, is the thing you say, isn't it? You know, was that always the intent, even from that first record, to go, you've got to be able to listen to this as a whole thing and enjoy it as a record? Was that always the intention?
No, absolutely. Because our heroes that we were basing our kind of careers on, if you like, were people like Kraftwerk, Cabaret Voltaire, people who made albums, electronic albums, you know, Propaganda, that kind of thing. You know, all those kind of bands, wasn't it? Front 242.
Because you can put, like, we're just going to put 10 solid noisy bangers that everyone loves together on the record, and it won't be a good record.
No, there were, back in the electro era, there were some brilliant artists, but some people went on to make albums and they just didn't hang together as proper albums. I can't explain why, and you can't put your finger on it, but there'd be a couple of good tracks. Yeah, dance albums weren't really working back then. Yeah, it was funny. I think the first one I heard that I felt was really good was the first 808 State album, New Build. I thought that felt like an album. That was like, yeah, okay, this is good. This is like prog rock, acid house, you know. It was great.
Listening to The First Time here on BBC Six Music, or BBC Sounds. I'm Matt Everett, and there'll be more from my guests, Paul and Phil Hartnell from Orbital, after this.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Discover Cillian Murphy's limited edition.
Well, welcome back to the basement.
A nocturnal mixtape designed to be played after dark.
I've been listening to an awful lot of music since we last spoke.
A place to hear music from all corners of Cillian's record collection.
So there'll be new stuff, there'll be old stuff, there'll be weird stuff, there'll be hopeful stuff.
A companion for anyone searching for something outside of the ordinary.
Music to provoke, music to stimulate, music that puts you in a different place.
Saturday sun.
Cillian Murphy's limited edition.
It's extraordinary.
To listen, just search Cillian on BBC Sounds.
Six Music. BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with Orbital.
Six Music. Sidebar question. First pair of glasses with talk to you. I'm assuming now you have some place in Sweden that makes them to your specific specification, but there must have been a point when it was just two mag lights and a bit of gaffer tape.
Yeah, the ones we've got now, we get them from the same place as James Bond. That's where he gets his stuff from.
The very first pair each. Yeah. Where did they come from?
They came from...
Space Age Gifts on Broadway.
That's it, Space Age Gifts. York. Star Magic, Space
they were,
Age
they
Gifts.
They were like $6 and you open up the things that you go around your ears.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you open those up and they've got battery housing in there, and when they connect with the lights at the front, they come on. But they're really rubbish at $6 a pop, you know. So I had to customise them, cut out the battery compartment, and just used the frame and stuck mag lights on. But the only mag lights you could get at that time were like these sort of 6-inch
really
ones.
Heavy.
Yeah, so then, really. So then I had to put a strap round the back to hold them on, and we used to come in a plaster across our nose, because you just look like you've been in a boxing match because of jumping around and the rubbing on the nose of the bridge, you know, and everything. And we went through loads of those.
We bought all of them. We did two gigs in New York. It was like our first tour supporting Meat Beat Manifesto.
But they were born from playing in acid house clubs, smoke machines and strobes, and not being able to see these little LED screens and everything like that. So it was born from a necessity, and we saw those, and we went, that is what we need.
It's like Jimmy Page's double neck guitar. It's the thing that people go, oh, that's awesome.
I know, we didn't even consider that.
We were the band that had Alien the ones, you know. I mean, it was great, because it meant I could see the smoke now that was getting in front of my little screen rather than not seeing it. But they do help.
Another thing that's passed into legend that we've spoken about before many times was that Glastonbury 94 performance. But I'm interested in, as it's his first, you opened with Forever, that Glastonbury set. But tell me about that first moment on that stage. Obviously, the gig went off, we know it's... That bit when you're like, this is... They're there.
I'll tell you what happened, first off. I mean, slight prequel. I was backstage because you had to tune all the synths every half an hour back then, because they were all mostly analog ones. So I was up there tuning everything, you know, a sea of road crew like I'd never seen before. And then I looked up and they'd all gone. I thought, what's going on? And then there was just this little woman stood behind the curtain, very pale and looking kind of quite frightened. And I just looked at her and thought, oh my God, that's Bjork. And she was just about to go on. Then you heard the beginning of Human Behaviour start. And then she stole herself and just rose like a ballerina and just looked like an 8-foot woman ready to go into battle and just whipped around the curtain. And it was just like, I'd never heard the roar of the Glastonbury crowd from the stage before. And I swear I ran off feeling like I needed to be sick. It was shocking. It's only one of two times that I've ever been sick before a gig of like dry heaving. You know, it was terrifying. But actually being on there and starting, like you say, with Forever was brilliant. The mistake we made is having only ever played it twice before. We didn't do like a best of set. We didn't know we were just promoting our new album, Snivelization.
That wasn't out. Yeah, there was a mistake in the tour to promote Snivelization and a release date.
We were playing all this new stuff on a massive stage on Saturday night.
People were gagging at the time for electronic sound. That's what they wanted. They didn't really support it. There was a lot of that rock and roll, well, the computer does it. There was a lot of ignorance, let's say, about how the music was actually made. But we sort of, because we mixed it up and had tracks like Satan, and we have come from a punk background as well, you know, we didn't care, and we've mixed it all up.
It's quite riffy, isn't it, what we do? I think a lot of the UK dance bands are quite riffy.
But what happened there, the penny dropped with Michael Eavis and Emily Eavis going, wait, is she? People are loving this with electronic music, which is actually really good for the trailblazing of what is now the dance field. And also, I get a lot of stories from people that were actually there that used to be indie kids. Oh, I used to be an indie kid. And then when I saw you, we seemed to be that, even with the NME as well, they were really good with us, very supportive, because it was very separate at the time. And it was really weird, you know. You're not allowed to listen to dance music if you're an indie kid, you know. Sort of how.
And then it all got broken
down. And that, we acted a bit of a bridge at that time for that And people, just from people telling me that, that they totally got it after they saw that performance and the crowd just kicked off.
I guess one of the good things about success and attention means you do get access to opportunities, working, meeting your heroes. Who are some of the people that you were like?
David Bowie. Oh, I used to have a painted David Bowie on my wall. I absolutely loved him.
And
then he did the Tim Drum thing and he curated one tent. And he invited us to play at the Phoenix Festival. Oh, my word, I can't only like...
When I met him the next day, he was in full battle dress. He knocked on the dressing room. I opened the door and there's David Bowie dressed for stage. He said, "Hi, I'm David." And it's like, I just went, ah. And then my wife came over and said, "Oh, hello, I'm Louise." And just shook his hand. And it's just like, wow, you're good at this, you know. But he was so lovely. He was charming.
Oh, Ralph Hutter, that's another. Well, I didn't actually meet him, but we did a strange remix of theirs once, and he even been in that position, like doing a Kraftwerk remix. I mean, we panicked, didn't we? We panicked.
How do you start?
Oh, well, I mean, and it was a really strange track. What was it? Expo 2000. So they did it for this thing, and so it was a really weird tempo, and we were quite. It was early on, wasn't it? It was quite fairly early on what we were doing, yeah. So anyway, we did the remix, sent it back, and it was answer phones, wasn't it? There was a message on the answer phone.
I've still got the tape.
Oh, have you? You haven't?
I have still got the
tape. Ralph, hello, this is Ralph.
Hello, it's Ralph Hutter from Kraftwerk.
Can you phone me back? I'm going, oh my God. Like, he made, I always had to do the phoning back. I like, quick vodka, like, hello. It's, yeah, I don't know, sorry about this. It's just, trying to imitate him, but he's going, yeah, so one thing, could you make it club bigger?
Club bigger.
Club bigger.
Yeah,
so we use that. I know. It's brilliant, isn't it? So we use
that.
Yeah. Of course, whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, for me, my biggest hero that I've met is Kate Bush.
Oh, yeah.
Which was astounding for me because she's such an enigmatic character. You never see her out and about. But
how did that happen? Tell me about that.
In the early noughties, we got invited. We got a letter with a royal seal on it, saying, please attend drinks and canapés at Buckingham Palace in recognition of contribution to the British music business. And I thought, yes, please, okay.
I thought, I am
going to get some of my tax money back on free gin and tonic. That's what I'm going
to do. The punk in me just could not do it. I go, oh, I'm so tempted. But how, Philip, can you go to the Queen's dinner party? It's like, no, I couldn't do it. But he went.
I was going. I was like, that, that's, you know, it's like all music biz royalty all there and that kind of thing. And while I was there, I met Brian Eno before and I saw him and someone said, look, he was talking to Kate Bush. And I went, right, I'm off. And I went over and said hello to Brian. He said, oh, hello, yes, yeah. Oh, have you met Kate before? Hello. You know, and she was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. No, she was fantastic. She was like slightly ethereal and crazy in a really funny bohemian kind of way. And then we're there like Brian Eno's talking us through the paintings on the wall saying, look at this one. No one's ever seen this painting before. And it's by this master. And then look at this one by this person. It's absolutely awful.
Because he knows about it.
Yeah, yeah. Brian Eno, of course he does. And then the people came through and said, okay, you need to stay in your group. Do not move. The Queen is coming through. Do you know? So I thought, oh, I've been locked in with Kate Bush. So I'm sat there. We were just talking about kids' names and things, just having proper, really good conversations. And never met the Queen, you know, but I met the Queen of Pop. You know, it culminated in her saying, oh, did you see that harpsichord in the other room? I said, yeah, yeah. He said, do you think it's in tune? I said, I don't know. He said, let's go and find out. And then we both ran round the corner, sat down on a piano stool together and both started hammering on this harpsichord to everybody turning around and looking. And I'm like, it's like, okay, I'm being looked at by Status Quo, Queen, Led Zeppelin. Oh, my God. And they're all looking and saying, oh, well, that's Kate Bush and some fella in a purple suit. It was just mind-boggling. Yeah.
Then she said something to the Queen, you told me, didn't you?
Oh, she asked the Queen for her autograph.
She asked the Queen for her autograph.
And she said, oh, I've made a real faux pas. She said, do you think that's all right? And I said, I think it's fine. I think it's fine. She said, yeah, they all came rushing over and said, no, the Queen doesn't do that. And she said, yeah, I just wanted it for my son. And, you know, it's like, excellent. Well, you know, that's what I mean by slightly wild,
but
you know, like
but
free thinker. You know, it's funny because I wanted to sample her recently, sent an email off asking for me. She sent a really nice one back just saying, no, I don't want my music taken out of context, but yes, of course I remember you. Wasn't your daughter called Daisy? And it's like, yes. She, you know, my daughter's very pleased that Kate Bush knows who she is, you know.
Okay, remember that we have just allowed an hour to get in, do it and get out. The sense of adventure is changing to danger. The signal has been given. I go in, the crime begins.
First time you split when you broke up was in 2004, as much as brothers can ever actually break up. But without wishing to put you on the psychiatrist's couch, what happened? Why the breakup?
I've got ADD. I'm quite very opposite to Paul. I'm like Tasmanian devil. What about the one? Philip, you just wait, you know. I can understand as somebody I would get quite irritating to work with and stuff like that. Paul's got his own ideas and stuff, wants to go off and, you know. So I don't know, maybe Paul's got a different story, but I looked at it as like he wants to go off and, you know, do his own thing. So that's when my DJ sort of started kicking in, because I had a couple of kids and go, oh, am I going to get some money now? And so I'm not a DJ, but anyway, at the time, I did get a couple of decks and learned it. I was a little breakbeat at the time, which I really loved. So I ended up going around to a lot of underground breakbeat clubs and earning my way through keeping the family going at that time, you know. So that was good, because I still do that now and I absolutely love it.
Well, I mean, obviously there's pages could be written on interband relationships and familial brother relationships, and when you put those things together, how much more complex that gets. But also, like, when it stops, is it like the sort of phantom leg?
Yeah, I mean, for me, no, it was a relief. Well, you know, we've done a lot. I started to have a family, and I was fed up with working with him. I was fed up with doing, you know, what I thought was most of the work and things like that. And I just thought, well, no, enough. If I'm going to do this, I'll do it for my family now, not for you, which was fine in the 90s or whatever. But for me, it was like, I need to get some space, go away and do my own thing. And I think for that period, I think it kind of saved our relationship, because we remained friendly after that, didn't we?
Yeah.
We did. And, you know, I was going to go off and go to Australia and New Zealand for a year, which I did. And, you know, he saw me off, brought the lads, his kids round, and we all had a last kind of meet up and that kind of thing. It was all left quite good. And then sort of a few weeks into the holiday, got the call from my older brother, Dr. Gary, that our mum was dying of cancer and would only had about 9 months to live. So a couple of weeks later, I was heading back to the UK. And that was quite tough, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was, you know, when I arrived back, you'd bought tickets to go and see Ennio Morricone, hadn't you?
That's right. Who's another huge influence on us, actually, film soundtracks, which obviously goes in line with the conceptual songs and things like that. And Ennio, my dad used to blast out Ennio Morricone, you know. So I bought tickets.
No, I managed to get him.
Oh, you get, because you weren't.
Yeah, old Dan. Our agent managed to squeeze me in.
With my mum, so we're sitting there with my mum and my dad, you know, and she was really poorly then, actually, and she managed to keep it together, sitting there holding her hands, you know, listening to, like, was the Mission or something?
The Mission was
I know. It was a moment. It was tough, but it was a moment that was a deep, meaningful moment, you know, and it was, well, it gives me goosebumps now, really, but yeah, it was a moment.
Yeah, I mean, on a more positive note, I'm going to do the name-dropping thing again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's all right.
Please do.
But I actually got to meet Ennio Morricone. I'd seen him at the Barbican a couple of times before, which was just down the road from where I was living, so I went both nights. And on the second night, the promoter said, oh, come and meet Ennio. And my wife was heavily pregnant at that point. And we went backstage, and there, it was amazing. He'd just literally come off stage, and the promoter said to me, come real quick, get out of there quickly, and I'll introduce you to him. He was there in a perfectly trim overcoat with a little pork pie hat, all ready to go, literally walking off stage, ready to go. And I presented him with a couple of CDs, got him to sign a couple of my albums. He was very dour, not doing anything. And then he looked at my wife's belly and his face just lit up and he just went, oh, Gela Bambina. Just like, I'm sorry about my Italian impression then, but he said something like that and just like put his hands on her belly and was just like beaming, like this little old Italian man, just with absolute joy about, you know, a new baby. And then he kind of walked off and went, I said, see you later, and walked off.
Blessed.
You know, yeah, so he blessed my child. It's like my daughter's had all the luck with that one rather than my two boys, you know. But she's been blessed by Ennio Morricone, and Kate Bush knows her name. When I'm about, I'm killing them now. I'm crazy, possessed, I'm a hideous gal. Everybody get down, let the cylinders foul. They know I got a different style. This beat is gonna be spinning around. There's the competition when they hit the rhythm is foul. It's me taking this money, it's wow. Doing your own, doing your wow, wow, wow. Got 'em all going psycho. Now, now, now.
The good thing about breaking up is that when you get back together again, maybe you realise how much people appreciate you. And so you did start again. And Wonky, good record. And all of a sudden now it's like something needs to be taken away for people to really appreciate it again. I guess you felt this huge wave of affection when it was like, oh, they're back.
Yeah.
It was about a kind of 5 year in between, which actually, I mean, to be fair,
we
lots
even had
of bands
a farewell
5 years
tour
between albums anyway, just, you know.
We did have a farewell tour at one point, didn't
yeah
we?
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got
yeah
very patient. I must say thank you to our fans because they're very patient with us and they stick with us, don't
oh
they?
Yeah, yeah.
All the loopers, they're great, great people. And actually, doing it so long, we can now see them bringing their children. We've even had a few grandkids in there,
yeah, yeah,
haven't we?
Three you know generations.
And just watching them. And we even have, like, up in Scotland that time, we have like the little kids, like, all their torch glasses and, like, all built all up right at the front. And it was amazing, wasn't it, to see that, you know, indoctrination. That's what we like.
So where are we now then, gentlemen? Where are we now? Where are Orbital?
Oh, wow.
Where
yeah
are we today?
Well, I mean, we're just about to do a tour with our first two albums in their entirety. Anyone's listening who's coming, we're starting early, just so you know, don't miss the
we're
beginning.
We're supporting ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to start with the Green album, have a break, and then do the Brown album. And I've always been quite sceptical about that kind of thing. But I thought, okay, let's give it a lash. Let's try it. And I've had the most fun reconstructing the Green album. We always used to record everything straight to DAT, just stereo. Mm. So I had to get old Atari ST computers and software and things like that. All the discs are working.
Yeah, so after 35 years, get all the data to be able to play it live.
To buy, you know, the old sampler that we used to have. And most things
amazing
are loading up. And it's just been the most fun reconstructing it all. And actually, you know what? It makes no difference whether it's a new album and then you decide to go out on tour. It's all stuff you haven't played. Or you get the Green album, which mostly we've never played. So it's like, okay, I may have written it 33 years ago, but it's still the same process. And the fun now of going on stage and playing all these tracks that we've not played live before is really refreshing.
We've got them all programmed now, pretty much, and we've been rehearsing over, really been heads down.
Oh, we got on it, didn't we?
Yeah,
I think we're more
it
prepared for
because,
this than
yeah
we've ever been before.
If we were to go and do a gig today, we've got a gig there, that's for sure. You know, it's just going to get better and better and better.
And other creative Orbital concerns going forward in the future?
Well, we've got
a Café du Mar remix coming out in April, which is sounding good. Actually, I played it out on Saturday at a gig in Poland, which, it went down really well. We've got the re-releases.
London Records are re-releasing the Green album soon with all the early singles that came out before it on vinyl and CD and things like that. So really nice kind of box sets of all of that stuff because, you know, a lot of our stuff's just not in the shops because it's not, it's all out of print. So, you know, we're starting that process of getting all the old stuff back out there.
So I suppose this year we're concentrating on the Green and the Brown album re-releasing. When we've done most of the tour, and we get on right to do the next Orbital studio album. Hopefully it'll come out next year.
The very last thing, we always ask you to pick the final track that we should play out on. It could be one of yours, it could be one of someone else's, it could be one of something you've heard this morning or something you've loved for your whole life. What should we go out on?
It has to be a joint thing, doesn't it?
I
thought that. Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, because that was a time that brought us together. Like, I was 16, he was 20. Our parents went to America for a holiday to Miami for 3 weeks and left him in charge. And we became great friends. And I was listening to anarcho punk at the time. He was listening to lots of electronic things. And then all of a sudden, I heard this track and thought, hang on a minute, this is fusing everything together. They've got the lyrics and the meaning of all the stuff I'm listening to, but with this amazing
political high energy, which was like, you go, oh, come on. It's like, brilliant.
Yeah, turned my head.
And the video is amazing, where they're fighting.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's been lovely to speak to you, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
When you hear the air attack warning, you and your family must take cover.
Was, of course, Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, the final choice of my guests on The First Time, Phil and Paul Hartnell, who are Orbital. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Self-Esteem. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, including my conversations with Tom York, Dave Grohl, Janelle Monáe, and the first ever First Time, which was with Johnny Marr. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.